It's true, you know, all you really do have to do is follow the money. North Carolina and its bathroom bill. Presidential politics, as always. Also today, in the music industry. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Monday, the 9th of May. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. There are lots of issues surrounding North Carolina's bathroom law, HB 2, it's technically called, the one that requires people to use the facilities that match the gender on their birth certificates. There are social issues, political, also today, legal issues. North Carolina Governor Pat McGrory has announced he is suing the federal government to keep the law in place. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch filed a suit of her own, calling the law discriminatory. There is also a whole slice of this thing that is straight up economic, which is where Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is going.
The Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority estimates the bathroom bill has cost more than $80 million in lost business. And that's just for Charlotte. It's happening elsewhere in the state, too. Aaron Nelson is president of the Chapel Hill Carborough Chamber of Commerce.
It's hundreds of jobs. And then the economic impact in terms of it's millions of dollars of lost conference revenue. And we're nearing the hundreds of millions of dollars of lost community investment impact. And that's just what we know.
Concerts are being canceled. Michael Jordan threatened to move the Charlotte Hornets. John Connaughton at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, says those are actually minor losses.
Those are not as big as corporate relocations that don't come here. Those are the really big ones that really have a much bigger impact because the money stays here and it's for a much longer period of time.
PayPal and Deutsche Bank have already changed their plans. Alan Fryer is an economist at the North Carolina Justice Center.
And unfortunately, we'll never know the full scale of the companies who quietly struck North Carolina off their list for putting a new plant in the state or expanding an existing facility.
The federal government is also threatening to pull funds from education, transportation, and elsewhere. A recent report from UCLA says that could cost the state more than $4.5 billion. Again, Alan Fryer.
To put this in context, the state budget this year is about $22 billion. So $4.5 billion represents almost a 20% of that overall budget line.
Not to mention all the legal fees from the lawsuits. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The march of presidential primaries continues. West Virginia holds its tomorrow amid another war of words over coal mining and the fate of that industry. Hillary Clinton has said, quote, "We're going to put a lot of coal miners out of business," end of quote, although she did later apologize for those remarks. Donald Trump has said, also quoting here, "We're going to put the miners back to work," end of quote. For those who are somehow under the impression that a president or any given policy can sink or save coal mining jobs writ large, allow us to introduce the thoroughly bipartisan theory of market-based economics, which suggests that many coal mining jobs, particularly in the eastern part of the United States, are never going to come back. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Say you drive a vintage Model T, a proud workhorse of the industrial age, and then all these new, cheap, and efficient cars whiz by. For West Virginia coal, natural gas is leaving it in the dust. Charles Patton is president of the Appalachian Power Utility in Charleston. He told a recent conference that natural gas may cost just $5 per unit of energy.
Forget the clean power plant. You could not build a coal plant that meets existing regulation today that can compete with $5 gas. It just cannot happen.
Now four of the top five coal producers are in bankruptcy. But okay, let's imagine natural gas somehow struggles. Well, energy economist Robert Godbe at the University of Wyoming sees a bigger problem. U.S. demand for energy in general is soft.
In fact, it's been almost flat demand since the Great Recession due to, you know, LED light bulbs. A lot of energy efficiencies, also the structural changes that are going on in the American economy. We don't have as much manufacturing and high electricity demand sectors.
So let's wave our magic energy wand again, and bam, coal prices rise. Well, the eastern mines still wouldn't recover, says Ted Bettner at the West Virginia Center on Budget Policy.
The coal seams are just getting thinner, so that means productivity is declining, so we can't produce as much coal with the same amount of people. We're just getting outcompeted by places like in Illinois and out west.
Keeping up would take super-efficient machines in West Virginia. But even there, the mining jobs would go away. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Now that the main contest in this fall's election is basically set, delegate math reality being what it is, Time for a new every now and then segment that we are going to call the soundbite.
The art of the soundbite.
Just like it sounds, we are going to play you a piece of tape, sometimes about the election, today for instance, sometimes about something else, and then we're going to tell you what's actually going on in that story. We started, in a way, on Friday with this from GOP nominee and all but fact Donald Trump, talking about how he might convince holders of U.S. government bonds that they are going to have to take a discount, a haircut, as bond traders like to say.
Debt was sort of always interesting to me. Now we're in a different situation with the country, but I would borrow knowing that if the economy crashed, you could make a deal.
That, as we said on Friday, would be irresponsible at best, dangerous, and globally destabilizing at worst. Today, though, from the Fair is Fair Department, another quote from Mr. Trump, also on the general topic of U.S. debt. Here you go.
People said, I want to go and buy debt and default on debt. And I mean, these people are crazy. This is the United States government. First of all, you never have to default because you print the money. I hate to tell you, okay? So there's never a default.
Here's the thing about that. He's right, technically. I mean, we do control our own currency, and we could print as much of it as we need to pay whatever debts we have. Hyperinflation, where there's so much money in circulation, an individual dollar eventually becomes worthless, and then the ensuing economic collapse, you know, notwithstanding. See also Germany after World War I. What or who else do you want to hear on the soundbite? Hit us up on Facebook, Twitter works as well. Take your pick. On Wall Street today, little up, little down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The nominees are known. Policy positions, at least we're hearing more about them. Also, the money, who's giving to whom and how much. Wall Street, it turns out, has decided it likes Hillary Clinton. The Wall Street Journal did the data journalism on this one and followed the money. Brody Mullins is a reporter at the Journal. He shared the byline in the paper today, and we got him on the line from our bureau in Washington. Hey, Brody, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's get the facts out there first. How much money are we talking about here for Mrs. Clinton from Wall Street?
From Wall Street, it's about $6 or $7 million that she's raised just in the last short period of time. More importantly, was the percentage of money that she's raised, which is she's now raising a majority of all the money that Wall Street's giving to all the candidates is now going into her campaign coffers.
Can we read tea leaves here and guess what that actually means about what Wall Street wants out of this election, or are they just playing the field as they do?
Absolutely. The whole idea is to read the tea leaves. And what the tea leaves are telling us is that Wall Street and lots of other corporate executives are very comfortable with Hillary Clinton, especially when she's compared against some of the other candidates like Donald Trump. They've known Hillary for a long time. She represented New York City and New York State for a long time. She has relationships with folks on Wall Street, and they are very comfortable with her.
Is that because, and I hate to fall back on this old trope, but Wall Street, as we know, hates uncertainty with Mr. Trump. There is some measure of the unknown with Mrs. Clinton. It's much more known.
That is exactly the point. Wall Street and other businesses really like to know what the rules are. They'd love to have rules that they prefer, but they really just want to know what the rules are, and they can adjust to them. They can deal with them. They can make decisions as a result of those. And with Hillary, they feel like they know what they're getting. And with Donald Trump, they have no idea.
Is it your sense that Mrs. Clinton is picking up Bush backers and Rubio backers and Cruz backers and all the rest of them?
Yeah, there were Wall Street, truth be told, in the beginning, really wanted Jeb Bush. He's someone who supported policies that would help Wall Street. And also he came with a lot of certainty. Once he went away, they seemed to start to play footsie and move over to Marco Rubio for his brief period when he was leading the polls or shooting up in the polls. And then once he left, the best alternative seemed to be Hillary Clinton. And what is surprising about that, of course, is that she's a Democrat. A lot of these Wall Street folks for the last several years have really supported Republicans, but now they're moving over to her as the best alternative.
One does have to ask where Donald Trump is in this mix and how much he's getting.
Well, it's a really good question. Part of it's hard to tell because he has just started to actively raise money. So far, he had funded most of his campaign out of his own pocket. He just announced last week that he's going to start raising money. So it's hard to tell by looking at the campaign finance reports how much money he's going to get from Wall Street. But the early indications are that that Wall Street is very comfortable with Hillary Clinton and not so comfortable with Mr. Trump.
Secretary Clinton I'm sure, is pleased and happy to have the money. I can't imagine a headline in the paper like yours has today saying how much money she's getting from Wall Street is going to help her win over Bernie Sanders voters.
It is a double-edged sword. She loves the money. She wishes it came from somewhere else. But it is what it is. I'm sure the Bernie Sanders people are going to make a big deal about how she's getting this Wall Street money. But it is what it is.
Yeah. Just a big picture question here, and then I'll let you go. In 2012, you write, the financial services industry gave something like $90 million to both candidates, that is Romney and Obama. Do we have a sense of what they're on pace for this year?
It's too early to say what they're on pace for. The general rule of campaign funding elections is that every 4 years, the amount of money donated goes up by about 50%. So we'll probably get a lot more than $90 million. You know, we've also had a bunch of changes in the campaign finance law,
right,
which now allow these new super PACs that have really taken flight this election to spend a lot of money. And those we've seen are also really heavily supported by Wall Street. So in terms of the overall amount of money that Wall Street is likely to give to candidates and to super PACs, it's likely to be way more than $90 million this time.
Brody Mullins, he writes for the Wall Street Journal. Brody, thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
Today in What Goes Around Comes Around, the online loan platform LendingClub, its founder and CEO has resigned after some uncomfortable questions about the company's business practices were raised. Shares were off 34% by the close in New York today. This is the latest bit of bad news for an industry that Wall Street had once been quite keen on. Often it's called peer-to-peer lending. You might know it by that name. Turns out, though, that things aren't quite as peer-to-peer as a lot of people thought. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains.
First, quick reminder of how old-school loans work. Craig Ficardi is a principal executive advisor at CEB.
A traditional bank gets its funds typically from retail consumer deposits, and then they use that money and then lend it out to other consumers that need loans.
Dead simple. If banks lend at a higher rate than they pay depositors interest, they make money. That worked okay for decades, but not so much in our era of risk-averse banks and low interest rates. Enter peer-to-peer lenders. A University of Cambridge report pegs peer-to-peer consumer lending at nearly $26 billion in America last year. That's up from just under $3 billion in 2013. With big money comes big change. Wharton professor Keith Weigelt says peer-to-peer might not even be the right name anymore.
If peer-to-peer originally meant person-to-person, it's definitely not person-to-person.
The original idea was that regular folks who need money could go to LendingClub or Prosper and connect with regular folks who had money. That still happens, but these days, lots of money is coming in big blocks from big institutions.
These investors, hedge funds, and so forth, they started seeing the sort of profitability, and then they started to jump in.
LendingClub, for example, went from no institutional investors in the beginning to about a third last year. Rajkumar Iyer, a finance professor at MIT's business school, explains what's drawing the heavy hitters to this untested space.
They basically want to get the maximum bang for their buck, so they are willing to take on this risk.
But as all this money from professionals pours in, tiny individual investors may find themselves running with a much faster crowd when they're picking and choosing the loans they back. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And then on the right there, there's some greenery where that truck is parked. That's the former property of Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt.
The business of those Hollywood star tours. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave up 34 points today, about 0.2%, ended at 17,705. Did the blue chips, the NASDAQ up 14 points, 0.3%, 47.50. The S&P 500 gained a point, we'll call it flat, 2,058. Krispy Kreme donuts baked up 24% today on news that JAB Holding, a German conglomerate, is buying it for more than $1 billion. It's a whole lot of donuts. JAB has been a coffee collector lately. Keurig Green Mountain, Pete's, and Caribou Coffee as well. Joy Global, a maker of mining equipment, did not have a good day, down 18%. Caterpillar, a competitor, off 3.5%. Among the big banks, Citigroup down 1%. Goldman Sachs down 0.8%. Today, bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Music fans among you will know that the British band Radiohead dropped a new album yesterday. It's called A Moon-Shaped Pool, and the release was preceded by a couple of other things. The band disappeared, basically, from the internet for a little bit, and then a couple of music videos popped up, so they've got some marketing savvy, but also some financial smarts, too. Alex Marshall wrote a piece for the Guardian newspaper about the band's business dealings, which are legion. We got him via Skype from London. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell me what happens at 41 Great Portland Street in Greater London.
It's from the outside, it looks like a sort of normal townhouse. It's a few doors down from the Republic of Congo's embassy, and it's next near a Pashmina shop. But it's actually the home of the UK's leading music industry accountants. And in my mind, it's the spiritual home of Radiohead today, because it's where they have all their companies. And Radiohead have a surprisingly large number of companies, about, you know, over 20 of them.
They set up different companies for each of their projects, right? Like, this new album has its own couple of companies.
This new album has two of them. There's one called Dawn Chorus and another one which is really badly spelt called Dawn Chorus. But they've done this for about the last few records, ever since they left EMI. And they've just started doing this completely different to every other band you can name.
Why do they do it this way? Do they just have a thing for financial accounting, or does it make some business sense?
Well, I wish they would talk to me about it and actually explain it. But when I looked into this, they avoided talking to me like the plague, and they ordered pretty much everyone who's ever had anything to do with their finances to shut up. But my guess, and this is only a guess from talking to people, is that it's a very good way of managing companies, of isolating them. So if a Radiohead album happened to fail, it would almost isolate it from failure. So no one could go and steal the profits they made with OK Computer or with the Bends. That's the obvious reason. Another reason, and this is where we get into murky, libelous territory, which I probably shouldn't say on the radio, but it's obviously got some tax advantages. Yeah. Very complicated and confusing scheme, and I wish Tom York would talk about it, but there's obvious reasons why he won't.
It's been true for a long time, but it seems to me ever more so in the new age of the music industry that we're in. If you want to make money at music, you have to be good at finance.
I think you do. I mean, many bands today, they're still having to work, you know, one, two jobs, you know, do bar work, be hairdressers to make a living. And if you want to allow yourself creative time and, you know, to invest in a lot of, as Radiohead do, a lot of weird instruments to make records, you need money. And the only way you're going to get that is by, you know, utilizing every tool you can. And just like, you know, a journalist on a radio show who probably fiddles his taxes a little bit to boost his income.
No, man.
Radiohead are doing that as well, just to give themselves an extra bit of space so they can spend more time in the studio making hopefully better records.
And it then gives them creative freedom, right? I mean, that's kind of the deal.
That is the deal. Although, you know, the problem is if you look back in time, you find some bands, obviously, when they make money, they don't churn it back into more records, and they actually just go off the hook in a delirium of drugs and booze. Radiohead fortunately don't do that, and you're finding more bands are reinvesting all their money into quite complicated financial structures to boost themselves and give themselves creative freedom. Kanye West is well known for doing this. Daft Punk, when they give interviews, bizarrely openly talk about finances. And I think Radiohead should shout more about this and be an example to others rather than trying to keep it as hidden as possible.
Alex Marshall is a music journalist in the UK. He writes for The Guardian. His piece on Radiohead is up now. Alex, thanks very much.
Brilliant. Take care. Bye.
You know how a lot of native New Yorkers have never been to the Statue of Liberty, or native Washingtonians who've never gone to the Capitol building? The very rough corollary out here in L.A. is the iconic bus tour of Starz Homes, a parade of tour buses on Rodeo Drive, Sunset Boulevard, and the Hollywood Hills, hours of people's lives filled with celebrity scandals and Hollywood lore for which they have paid money. So, Marketplace's Adrian Hill got on the bus.
Hello, hello. Can y'all hear me back there?
It's Monday afternoon. I find my seat on the small white tour bus run by dearly departed tours.
By the way, sit back, relax, and rest in peace.
2.5 hours of death, Hollywood style.
You saw the news footage when Michael had died. These gates on the right here are the gates the ambulance was coming out from.
Troubled relationships.
Right here on your left.
The light post where Chris Brown assaulted Rihanna.
Anybody want to do
and good old-fashioned stargazing. Or more accurately, hedge gazing.
And then on the right there, there's some greenery where that truck is parked. That's the former property of Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt.
Only a decade too late to actually spot them. Scott Michaels owns Dearly Departed Tours.
It's very competitive. When I started my company 11 years ago, there were probably maybe 8 or 9 companies.
Today, it's closer to 40. Many offer a tour or two a day. Others prowl Hollywood nonstop. Michaels is in the small group with really good online ratings. He says many of the upstarts are just guys with minivans.
It's really whoever you can wrangle to get in your bus, which is parked right around the corner kind of a thing. And it's really a deeply unpleasant vibe.
The epicenter of the star tour industry is Hollywood Boulevard. You can't go half a block without somebody trying to sell you a tour for anywhere from $20 to over $100.
Starline tours, Starline tickets, TMZ, hop on, hop off, movie stars' homes.
There have been fights and shouting matches between the tour operators.
Laurent Gubler heads up the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce. He says the fights are basically turf wars. Which operator will hawk tourists on which corner of which block? Gubler says they've toned it down recently. His office is pushing for a code of conduct for tour operators, and
there's other things. You know, over the years, we've suggested some training for tour operators. To be sure that what they are telling the tourists is accurate, because we've been on tours and cringe at some of the things that the tour operators say.
Most of the time, though, they get away with it. Because how many people really can fact check for themselves which gated estate is home to Simon Cowell or Jodie Foster? But the concerns over accuracy haven't slowed the battalion of tour buses that continue to wind up and down Sunset Boulevard and through the streets of Beverly Hills. Roxanne Moster is one of my tour mates back on the Dearly Departed tour.
It's my sister Kathleen's birthday, so we thought it would be a really fun way to celebrate.
And what better way to celebrate birth, I guess, than with death? A tiny cemetery tucked between towering office buildings and a residential neighborhood.
This is Carl Wilson of the Beach Boys. Paul Gleason was an actor.
Marilyn Monroe's grave is also here. Her tomb is covered in lipstick kisses, real ones that have turned it a smeary shade of pink.
We've been living in Los Angeles all these years, and we've actually never gone on a Hollywood tour.
Neither had I. Or a whole lot of the rest of the population of Los Angeles. But as long as the tourists keep coming to get close to Hollywood stars, tour companies will keep driving them and fighting over driving them. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Okay, a couple of final things on the way out today. First of all, a follow-up to the story we did last week about background checks for rideshare drivers in Austin, Texas. Locals rejected a proposal by Uber and Lyft to overturn some city rules that would have required drivers to be fingerprinted. The companies have stopped operating in Austin, making it the biggest U.S. city without Uber service in it. Also, the bison is now officially the official mammal of the United States of America. President Obama signed that bill this afternoon. I, however, still think humans are getting short shrift on this one, being mammals as we are. Also, and really, finally now, this one about which I'm just not sure, truth be told. Ad Age is reporting that Budweiser's got a new summer marketing campaign in the works. The company has filed for approval to replace the name Budweiser on its labels with the word America. Liberty and justice for all, land of the free and home of the brave, and indivisible since 1776 appear in smaller type. I don't know, grab me a cold America from the fridge, will ya? Just doesn't ring true to me. Also, it's just, it's bad beer. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. Your gift in any amount will be automatically doubled this month thanks to the generosity of Newman's Own Foundation. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. All right, we're out of here. The Dow Industrials gave up 34 points today, 17,705. The NASDAQ rose 14 points, 4,750 there. The S&P 500 up a point, we'll call it basically flat, 2,058. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.